Friday at 5 p.m. And as we are still recording our
theme song,
we're recording our show from home, so we've taken to singing it before we actually start the show for ourselves. I'm Tom Ryan, your host for the next hour.
Things.
It's my lovely wife and co-host Heidi Morales Ryan here as well. This being Friday, it is our How Music Changed series that we will be doing. And we've recently started a series dedicated to the incredibly fascinating career of Duke Ellington. This is part six that we're going to cover today. And although it feels to me like we're moving at a quick pace, this covers the year 1933. I mean, this is truly incredible. Six shows, no wasted time, tons of history, and we're still in 1933. Oh my gosh.
So much more to go.
Yeah. And believe me, it's going to stay, I promise you, it's going to stay interesting, and the changes are incredible. You know, Duke has been through so much musically, and he's responsible for so much innovation that it would be criminal if we were going to do anything more than pay him the ultimate respect that he deserves. So let's get this party started. As I said, the year that we're going to be covering is 1933, and by the early to mid-30s, Ellington's impact became so ubiquitous that his reputation crossed the ocean. Very few American jazz artists had that sort of reputation. Louis Armstrong had just been to Europe and been back. Questionable reviews because the staid English didn't know what to make of a black man who was hamming it up on stage and constantly patting his face with a white cloth, you know, from taking care of his sweat. They thought that it was perhaps a bit unbecoming and maybe improper. But this is Duke Ellington, one of the most proper of black men ever, and somebody who is basically
of any man, really.
Of any man, really, exactly. I'm glad you said that. And he was out to basically prove something about his race and his people. That was a big part of, you know, dignity was a huge part of what Duke was about. And because of his music specifically, he was revered in England. And Ellington himself was stunned to see how the English music fans had accrued so much arcane knowledge about his songs. Free of the racial tensions that plagued America, it was apparent that the British judged Ellington by his talent and were obsessed with every detail about his catalog of songs. So as I mentioned, this year, this show covers the year 1933 when he made his first overseas trip to England. And we'll pick up just before that happens with talking about Duke and race relations here in America. I'm going to read excerpts from a book by Harvey G. Cohen called Duke Ellington's America. Ellington frequently mentioned the musical works he wrote that illustrated black history and life, and that, as he said in 1965, his work in this direction preceded Quartz and Nightsticks. In an interview from the early 1970s, he went into more detail. Black Beauty was written in 1928. Black and Tan Fantasy was in 1927, Creole Love Call in 1927. And it's always been black something all the way up. Jump for Joy, which we did in 1941, was the first socially significant review. We've always been pioneers in everything we did. We pioneered the movie theaters for bands. We pioneered the social movement with the history of the Negroes in America, with black, brown, and beige. And every year after that, in Carnegie Hall, I don't think there's been any doubt how we felt concerning prejudice, but still, the best way for me to be effective is through music. Ellington proved skillful in his own history and work to establish his civil rights bona fides without sacrificing his view of how the struggle should be waged. He supported the cause with action, money, and commanding respect, while resisting adoption of the more militant methods of the period. when a Dallas reporter asked Ellington to assess whether his music had, quote, helped in any way with race relations, unquote. Ellington replied, there would be no way to take a census of this. You try to make your contributions. You try to do it with dignity and to command respect. This is our life. Our responsibility is not only to our people, but to America and to our fellow man. In 1933, he made a new recording of Creole Love Call, already updating his own material. Here is that second version from 1933 on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC. A second extended version of Creole Love Call. The first version, you might remember, Heidi, when we played it, had a female voice that did a sort of growl for the call and response. like that, then in a way, it's what he's doing is two things at the same time. He's extending his compositions, proving that they're classic, and also dignifying them by saying that they're worth going back to rearranging and changing the structure for a variety of reasons. Very, very, very smart.
Classing
man.
It up.
Very smart. Duke Ellington's career was an overall operation consisting of much more than merely securing engagements for him or selling his songs. Again, I'm going to be taking this from Harvey G. Cohen's book, for credit where credit's due. This is his manager, Irving Mills, talking here.
Okay.
Anyone could have done that. My exploitation campaign was aimed at presenting the public a great musician who was making a lasting contribution to American music. I was able to guide Duke Ellington to the top of his field, a field in which he was the first to be accepted as an authentic artist, because I made his importance as an artist the primary consideration. They worked well together.
Yeah.
The Mills emphasis on quality and respectability assigned special emphasis to visual image. During the Mills era and well into the 40s, the band dressed immaculately on stage, sporting tailored and elegant tuxedos. Everything was first class, every time you looked around. Mills said, I better get you guys another set of uniforms, remembered the drummer Sonny Greer. Every time we opened up, we had boutonniere flowers. He was there to see everything was perfect. Every show, we had a different uniform from top to bottom. Irving Mills was a very shrewd man, and he knew that appearance was half the battle. The battle was for both profits and having respect paid to a skilled African-American musician. The monies that I spent on Duke for photographs, for clothes, for publicity, I don't think that anybody ever spent on anybody what I did for Duke, recalled Irving Mills decades later. His Duke's son, Mercer, wrote that this emphasis on a dignified appearance extended to the design of the band's elegant stage set. Paul Mills, the son of Irving, confirmed that such attention to detail was part of the marketing scheme to promote the band to as large an audience as possible. The Mills organization wanted the name of Ellington and his orchestra to stand out. The sound of the band, the look of the band, immaculately dressed, uniformed on the stage. Well, the band was under Mills' artists. They were always almost like a military unit.
He's a bit of a genius.
Right?
Yeah.
They were precision musicians, and they had the same uniforms, good-looking tuxes, things like that. Satin, shiny tuxedos, those pictures of men in tuxes sold the band. To help in the same way, it's also a matter of choosing material. While Duke was writing most of the stuff that the band was doing, he was also finding older material. A song by Alec Wilder that dated back to 1917 that was a hit gets, again, reworked and modified by Duke Ellington. His version updated it and made it a hit again in 1933. We'll play that song called Rose Room, and we'll segue that into Blue Ramble, which came out at pretty much approximately almost the exact same time, really, on 90.3 WHPC. Mm-hmm. Two tracks back to back there. What we just heard was called Blue Ramble. And before that, Rose Room. I should just, for the sake of clarification, mention this. This is really before the era of big bands. So you might be hearing this and thinking of this in terms of the context of, well, everybody was doing this sort of thing. In 1933, that's definitely not true. The biggest band in the United States at this point in time is probably the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, who called himself the King of Jazz. But he played as much sweet music as anything else. He certainly did a good job of playing jazz. And I don't mean to demean Paul Whiteman at all, but Duke Ellington and his orchestra were upping the game to an extent that was just unimaginable at this point in time. It was definitely something new. And it was what would inspire what became the big band era, really. It stemmed from these exact songs and what Duke was doing. To continue then, we're talking about their performance. He goes, their dramatic approach to performance drew rave reviews during the initial years of touring after the Cotton Club and required the presence of a full-time electrician. Jack Boyd was his name, and a separate electronic board because the presentation was too complicated for most technicians in theaters. A Memphis reviewer documented the scene at the Orpheum in 1933. Ellington's swift fingers on the keys, the trim orchestra sharply outlined against the scarlet curtain, odd, pulsing music whose effects are heightened by skillful lighting. It's a good show and a rare one. The drama surrounding the band's stage presentation complemented the band's singular approach to music, according to the same Memphis reviewer. Ellington has made a name for himself as composer and arranger, a thorough modern in feeling and method. Another critic, commenting on the band's 1933 Southern tour, noted that the band's presentation is particularly well staged and lighted against colorful drapes of red and gold velvet. Mills and Ellington created a new standard, not just for popular music, but for its presentation as well. This is around the time that Irving Mills starts thinking, maybe I should get this guy in playing in Europe.
Ah.
Now, the emphasis on an image of respectability also provided a strong counterargument to critics who accused jazz, especially as performed by blacks, of being a musical genre that somehow imparted values of immorality and depravity. Mills respected Ellington's music and realized that an elite visual image would help it cross over into the more profitable world of white music, quote unquote, as well. An elegantly attired African-American orchestra would appear less threatening to white audiences of the 1930s, who, told of genius and assured of class, would be more likely to purchase Ellington's sheet music, show tickets, and recordings.
Marketing.
Again, there's a genius here that was going on. Let's play two more tracks back to back. The first, since we just spoke a little bit about the Cotton Club, is called Drop Me Off at Harlem, and we'll segue that into Bundle of Blues on American Hit Radio 90.3 WHPC. Thank you. sophisticated, classy. It's still swinging. But this is the 30s, and Ellington, being a black man, was definitely fighting an uphill battle all the way, as you can imagine. Not all American critics adorned their columns concerning the Ellington Orchestra with highbrow pretensions. Many combined descriptions of this aspect of the band's activity with depictions of how primitive, fast, and sensuous their dance numbers were. Such descriptions were not surprising, as Ellington shows obviously contained compositions that featured raucous as well as more temperate aspects of the band's personality. He wrote for his band's personality. But a Detroit reviewer speculated that, quote, even an African savage would find that the band's hot numbers were barbaric to the point of savagery.
Oh, come on.
The San Francisco Examiner acclaimed the Ellington Orchestra as, quote, the most accomplished jazz orchestra, and praised two of their members as outstanding examples of abstract jazz, but also commented on the aboriginal voodoo throbs in the music. Besides highlighting some racial stereotyping, such juxtapositions showed Ellington's resolute refusal to be corralled into any category, high or low. A performer accepted on many levels, Ellington and Mills knew, could attract more bookings and afford Ellington increased freedom as a writer as well as a performer. It was around this time, though, that Ellington very much took the high road and composed a song that became one of the biggest hits of his career, certainly one of the biggest hits of his early career. Recorded this in 1933 as an instrumental recording, eventually recorded a number of versions with lyrics that were somehow, Irving Mills gets involved with the lyrics quite often when they're written, but ended up with a huge hit in this regard. Here is the 1933 version then of Sophisticated Lady on American at Radio 90.3 WHBC. Thank you. need to credit the soloists on that track because it's just so gorgeous. It's Toby Hardwick, who played alto sax, Barney Bigard, the New Orleanian, on clarinet. Lawrence Brown played the trombone solo. And the piano, I mean, boy, Duke is so good. he's so good in particular on that track. And it's right about this time that the band is ready to leave for England, taking that song with them their latest hit. So this is from Duke Ellington's memoir called Music Is My Mistress. Irving's next coup was an engagement at the London Palladium, which he arranged in association with the British bandleader Jack Hilton. The Palladium was then regarded as the number one variety theater in the world. We sailed from New York on June 2, 1933, on the Olympic. Crossing the Atlantic for the first time was an exciting experience for all of us. There were many delegates aboard from all over the British Commonwealth, and they were going to a big conference in London. We played a concert and made some valuable friends among them. We had a terrific reception at the Palladium. Avi Anderson broke it up every time with stormy weather. Bessie Dudley danced and shook to Rockin' and Rhythm, and we played Ring Damn Bells and Three Little Words to tie up with the Amos and Andy movie. We always got a good response to Mood Indigo, too. What Duke was intent on doing with playing those exact songs was bringing his hits to England, thinking that he needed to introduce himself in a sense.
Right.
So that's exactly what his intent is here, and it's why he played a version of this song. Here is Stormy Weather on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHBC. I should mention that the song was a new hit that was sung by Ethel Waters at the Cotton Club in 1933, and it caught on like wildfire, and it was only a matter, it was only natural that Duke would be doing his own version. So here he is, his version of Stormy Weather. Thank you. beautiful, classy, what else, rendition of that song.
For sure.
Now, Duke ends up in England, and he's so astounded because the British seem to know more about his music, not only more than Americans, more than he does. This is his own...
reminding him of his own history.
This is his own quote in Music is My Mistress. We were absolutely amazed by how well-informed people were in Britain about us and our records. They had magazines and reviews far ahead of what we had here. And everywhere we went, we were confronted with facts we had forgotten and questions we couldn't even answer. Because nevertheless, the esteem that our music was held in was very gratifying. A broadcast we did for the BBC provoked a lot of comment, most of it favorable. Constant Lambert, the most distinguished British composer of that period, had written an appreciation of some of our early records years before. Now, his beautiful Eurasian wife inspired a new composition.
Cool.
When she referred to Mood Indigo as Rude Interlude. I guess that had something to do with my American accent, he wrote. Here's the song that Duke composed specifically because of that misunderstanding of Mood Indigo. On American Radio 90.3 WHPC, here's Rude Interlude. Yes, cool, because that's an example of a song that Duke was composing in his head while he was in England, based upon a comment. But he was also recording when he was there. He actually ended up going into Decca Studios in London, and he had a song that he wrote sort of as an answer piece. There was a movie in 1930 called Africa Speaks, and Duke thought he could work off of that. And he wrote a piece called Harlem Speaks.
Cool.
A totally upbeat swing number recorded, as I said, you know, in London, England, while he was on tour. And it eventually became the name of an album by Duke Ellington. But this is, you know, just basically Duke trying to basically play hot for Europe, getting a film. Maybe that's what they wanted. On American at Radio 90.3 WHPC. I hope you enjoy Harlem Speaks. A new original number from Duke called Harlem Speaks that he recorded, as I said, while he was in London, England, with an amazing band. I mean, his famous orchestra at this point, just Arthur Wetzel, Cootie Williams, Freddie Jenkins on trumpet, Lawrence Brown, Joe Nanton, Juan Tizol on trombone, Barney Bigard, Johnny Hodges, Otto Hardwick, all like trading between
all-star
clarinet.
All-star cast there.
Yeah. Harry Carney, also, I should mention, my God, four guys like alternating between clarinet and alto sax. Freddie Guy on guitar, Wilman Brown on bass, and Sonny Greer on drums, and Ivy Anderson singing when it called for it. Rather incredible. There was this really interesting document. I don't need to talk about it because actually you can hear Duke Ellington talk about it.
Oh.
So I'll let him. This is actually released as a 78 RPM release in Great Britain called A Souvenir of Duke Ellington on American Net Radio 90.3 WHPC.
Hold it, Duke. Hold it. Surely that's not the way you're feeling. I thought you'd have something more lively to say than that.
Well, I don't know that I'm feeling altogether cheerful. Certainly everything has been so fine and people so nice that I ought to be feeling good. But after all, this is really my farewell, and you can take it from me that I don't want to go.
Sure, I know how you feel. But you're not gone yet, and after all, it's only going to be a case of Auf Wiedersehen, isn't it?
I hope so. Just as soon as possible, we will be back again. If it doesn't turn out to be an annual trip, I'll be the most disappointed man in the world.
Is that because you've discovered how well your work is known and appreciated over here?
Largely, I suppose. Although I must say that it has been positively embarrassing at times to be asked the most analytical questions about work which I have nearly forgotten by now.
Well, you'll have to write some new numbers. And by the way, have you got any in mind?
Yes, I have. I want to write a rude song. This was accidentally suggested by Mrs. Constance Lambert, who referred to our little melancholy tune as Rude Indigo. All I need for the number now is the balance of the title to go with Rude.
I shall have to leave that to you. Incidentally, everyone is anxious to know which of your own compositions is your favorite.
That's a difficult one to answer. The things I've liked best, I've often left on the shelf. But of my published and recorded numbers, I think I like Mood Indigo best.
Do you think rhythmic music will ever become a divorce from the ballroom and find a permanent home in the concert hall?
Yes, inevitably. But perhaps not in this generation. It is the youngsters of these days who will make the audiences of tomorrow, and they have no prejudices of which they must rid themselves.
That sounds logical enough. And now there's just time for you to say goodbye.
No, I refuse to say goodbye. Au revoir is the word, and it comes from the bottom of my heart.
Something about that, it moves me. It's so obvious
that they're reading from a script.
Right. They're both reading scripts. It's stiff in that regard.
Right.
But I've heard very similar things from around this era where they would do something similar and it would be incredibly meaningless. It would just be almost painful to listen to. Duke doesn't seem to, I mean, whatever he says, it sounds like he wrote what he wanted,
right,
what he wanted to say. His answers
dictate what his real answers were.
There's meaning to what he adds to his answers. He discusses the fact that he's overwhelmed by the knowledge of the Europeans.
Yeah.
He brings up the story of how he's thinking of writing a song called Rude Interlude,
right,
or Rude Indigo, I think, as he called it at the moment,
right,
which turned into the song that we played. And basically just the details mattered there. And even the interview is dignified, even if it is stiff enough to be read.
Sounds a little contrived. But
it wasn't like he passed on it and let somebody else write it for him. He obviously wrote what he said.
Right.
And I find that to be, pretty darn cool for a 1933 recording situation. We've got time for one more track. So let's drop this in. I think it sort of perfectly summarizes my attitude about Duke Ellington and his music from this era and this show in particular with the reception that he received in England. It's called I'm Satisfied on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC. Thanks so much, folks, and we hope to see you next Friday for part 7. Bye-bye. Thank you.
just to be at your side. In all the bliss I ever want to find, I'm satisfied deep in your arms to hide and feel the kiss that brings me peace of mind. Am I contented when I'm with you? Yes, indeed. Your love for me is all the food and drink I need. The world is wide and will drift with the tide. Just as long as you're mine, I'm satisfied.